From the Moon Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, 10 years after writer Nell Scovell called out her former boss, David Letterman, they meet to hash it out. Then Kim Gordon talks about her debut solo album and her artistic life after Sonic Youth.
I think I've come to terms with what personal would be, and I think it just means to do things in your own way. There's no one way, right way to be an artist or have an art career or a music career.
And we'll meet the director of Atlantiques, Senegal's official Oscar entry for Best Feature Film. All that coming up on The Frame. 10 years ago, TV writer Nell Scovell took a pretty big risk. She published an article calling out her former boss, late night king David Letterman, for running a writer's room and a show that favored men. Scovell has since co-authored Sheryl Sandberg's 2013 book, Lean In, and last year she published the memoir, Just the Funny Parts and a Few Hard Truths About Sneaking into the Hollywood Boys Club. For her latest piece in Vanity Fair, Scovell met with Letterman to finally talk about gender discrimination at late night. Scovell joined me in studio and described what it was like to write for Letterman in 1990.
Yeah, so this was a dream job for me. I had already worked in Los Angeles. I'd actually worked on the last season of Newhart, and I'd written a Simpsons episode. And I finally, after years of sending material to the Letterman people, got a call asking me to come in and meet with Dave.
And like a lot of late night shows, not a lot of women in the writer's room.
No, there'd only been one before I got hired. It was Meryl Marco, who was a genius and the first head writer on that show, and also Dave's girlfriend at the time. So I guess I was the first female hired who wasn't in a relationship with Dave.
So many years after you leave the show in 2009, something compels you to write about your experiences there, right?
Dave was the victim of a blackmail attempt. He was having an affair with one of his assistants whose boyfriend found her diary. And the scheme was that he threatened to write a screenplay about the affair if Dave didn't give him $2 million. At the same time, Nancy Franklin writes a piece in The New Yorker that points out that there were zero female writers on Letterman, Leno, and Conan. And I have to say that Dave's announcement was not a surprise. Anyone who worked on the show knew about his extracurricular activities. But the fact that I'd been gone for 20 years and they'd moved backwards as far as gender in the writer's room, that was astonishing to me. And I literally lost sleep.
So on a fast forward to a decision you make, and certainly there's another party to this conversation, which is going back to David and saying, I want to have a conversation about the fact that you didn't respond to what I wrote. And how did that come about? Because there seems to be an important condition, and that is that it's on the record.
As we approached October 2019, I knew it was the 10-year anniversary of this article I had written for Vanity Fair. And then I just got this crazy idea, which is, would Dave sit down and talk to me? And I knew he hadn't read the article because in this weird coincidence, he and I ended up working together in 2014 on the Kennedy Center Honors. And I actually had a chance to ask him, did you ever read that article? And he said to my face, no, I don't worry about that stuff.
Don't worry about that stuff.
Meaning he doesn't worry about what people write about him.
Is that what it means, or he doesn't worry about how he behaved and how he treats women?
He claims it is the former.
When you sat down with David, I'm curious, what was the most striking thing that he had to say?
Well, first of all, it was pretty extraordinary that he agreed to sit down with me. If you do any reading about apologies and someone who's wronged, you find out that as the person who's been wronged, you lose status. And so the second Dave agreed, we'll sit at a table and talk, he really did offer me this status, right? We were equals at that table. And I would love to see more powerful white men doing that sort of thing, which is being open to that discussion. So the point was not just for me to get what turned out to be an apology from Dave, but also to try to model behavior that I would like to see more of.
We're talking with TV writer and author Nell Scovell. You mentioned in your Vanity Fair piece how male writers' rooms have been for people like Jay Leno. And he has no regret and no apology.
No, it's all about the material. Just if you give me good material, then I will hire you. You know, just come up to me in a comedy club, he says. You know, Jay Leno went off the air with zero female writers. I mean, he should be ashamed of that for the rest of his life.
What would you say are the things that make you optimistic about how conversations are changing, not just in and around this issue, but in the workplace, about a showrunner's interest in hiring a room that looks like the country, not like the country club?
I do think we've made some improvement, and I think it certainly helps to have people like Kenya Barris and Shonda Rhimes, you know, who have been so successful, and Ava DuVernay. They're all doing amazing work. And I think it's Shonda who made an amazing observation, which is if you walk outside, you see people of all colors. You see people from all walks of life. That's normalcy. So we actually shouldn't call it diversity. What we want is normalcy. You know, in 1990, I went to the Emmys for the first time. Letterman had been nominated. And I was in the audience when they announced the nominees for the 5 best comedies. And it was Murphy Brown, Golden Girls, Designing Women, Wonder Years, and Cheers. 3.5 of those shows were created by women. Diane English won for Murphy Brown. And I sat there in 1990 and thought, we solved this. We proved it.
You're such a dreamer.
No, I just want to get back to where we were in 1990.
Nell Scovell is a TV writer. She's the author of the memoir, Just the Funny Parts and a Few Hard Truths About Sneaking Into the Hollywood Boys Club. Nell, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Coming up on The Frame, Kim Gordon has been in bands since 1981, including Sonic Youth. Now she's released her first solo album. Kim Gordon is best known as the bassist and singer of the New York City-based no-wave band Sonic Youth. But her artistic output goes way beyond music. She's a fashion designer, actress, visual artist, and poet. She published a memoir in 2015 called Girl in a Band. Gordon has also released albums under her side project called Body Head, but now she's celebrating her debut solo album. It's called No Home Record. It's a collaboration with producer Justin Raisin. We met recently at 10 in the morning, so we started with her loudest song. It's called Murdered Out.
Sorry, I'm not awake yet.
This will wake you up. I think this is the first song that you put together with your producer, Justin, is that right?
Yeah.
Can you tell a little bit about that song and how it came together and the conversation that you and Justin had leading up to recording it?
Well, kind of happened sideways. He was working on another project and having different people come in and play instruments and sing, and he kept sending me songs. How about this one? Nope. And then there was one that I felt the sensibility I could. I was kind of curious about what his whole deal was, and I thought it would be a good way to kind of work with him a little bit and see what that was like. And he kind of really got my sensibility, and so I went back and I did more vocals and added some guitar, and we mixed it and that just became Murdered Out.
When you're making your first solo album, is that liberating in a way that there's no pattern or model that you have to follow? Can you just start essentially from scratch in terms of what you want to do?
Yeah, I guess it was liberating. you know, I just didn't really think about it that much. I kind of like the hip-hop model of just starting with a rhythm and building stuff up. even though I wasn't making a hip-hop record. And I don't know, I just like the kind of appropriative attitude within it. And my vocal style is not as a conventional singer. So that was somewhat of a model, you know, even though there aren't really any hip-hop songs on it.
You're describing some of this music almost like it's a collage of a visual artwork. Would you describe it more like painting or poetry? I mean,
because
so many different things in so many different mediums.
I mean, I think collage is kind of a good, like that song Sketch Artist actually, I think, is the most collaged song.
The wind chimes strike, your dead stare strikes, and the wind chimes strikes, and your dead stare strikes.
That's a song I recorded and sent to him, and the way he put it together is totally different. I don't even remember what the original was, but the other song I sent him, Get Your Life Back, is pretty much the same. It's the same structure, and that is more like kind of a, almost like a poem or something.
What are the differences? How would you define what is a poem versus what is a song?
Well, I just figured whatever I gave him, he'd make into a song. It was almost like a challenge.
You said in your book, as a conversation you had with Danny Elfman, you said, Danny said to me once, your art is very personal, so it'll be popular. And you write, personal is something I still equate with Sunday painters. I still carry around with me a battle between working conceptually, art based on some overriding idea, and my pure carnal sensory love of materials.
I think I've sort of come to terms with what personal would be, and I think it just means to do things in your own way. You know, not everyone, there's no one way, right way to be an artist or have an art career or a music career. And I find that I sort of have the art career that suits me. Like, I think I would have been bored if I was just a painter.
Or just a singer?
I mean, not that there's anything wrong with that. It just doesn't suit me.
Do you think that's been helpful to you to have different disciplines? Because listening to you say that, I was thinking about how hard this business is and how hard people's expectations of what you should do and how you should look. Is there a lesson that you took away that has made you survive?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think that most women are, it's like in your DNA, it's almost pathological, this desire to please or something. And I mean, it's not just, you know, men have different pressures that are very similar, you know, like the expectation to be responsible. I don't know, I guess it's made me just aware of that. Like, you never feel like you're going to ever arrive anywhere because you have to do everything. You have to balance everything. If you're a mom, work, you know, and then work and then be creative and looking good and everything. So mostly I'm actually too lazy to do a lot of that. I really just try to focus on what's most important.
So when you have a conversation with somebody like your daughter, who is an artist, what do you tell a young artist about how to measure success and happiness, about what the goal should be about pursuing a passion?
Well, I think you have to really be sure you want something, because you might just get it.
You might get it accidentally?
What does that mean? I mean, like, you, if you achieve something, you could look around and go, well, is this really what I want? Is this meaningful? You know, or am I just doing this because I'm good at it? Or, like, for instance, bands are really like machines. I mean, you get in it and you just go, go, go until you don't go anymore. And the lifestyle is structured in a way that it's hard to do other things. And there's a lot of boring parts, you know, waiting around, sitting in airplanes and airports and buses. And then there's the whole being known part. And not everyone can deal with that. And in Sonic Youth, it was I think we kind of always had this edge of, well, we kind of had a niche audience, but we could still do other things because we didn't have the trappings. Still, to be a visual artist, it's difficult because most people know me as a musician. So that's been kind of challenging.
We're talking with Kim Gordon about her record, No Home Record. I'm wondering, when you are recording these songs, are you thinking about a specific person who is the narrator of a certain song?
Some, you know, I have done that in the past. Like, well, with Hungry Baby, it's sort of, you know, it's about sexual harassment, and but it's from the point of view of the man. So that's kind of specific, I guess.
Let's listen to a little bit of the song Hungry Baby. You said that this is written from the point of view of a guy. How did that song come together, and why was that important to write from that perspective?
Well, I wrote a song called Swimsuit Issue, like in 91 or something, that was about sexual harassment. Right after we signed to Geffen, there was an incident, and with a well-known A&R person. And then, I don't know, when all the Me Too stuff was going on, I just thought, I should maybe update it. Or, you know, just why not go back into that territory?
How do you think that your music reflects the things that are happening in the country and the world today? And are you intentional about referencing it, but also intentional about not overloading it?
Yeah, I am intentional about exactly referencing it, but not being pointed, because I feel like music works well when there is room for the listener to project and take what they want from it.
You wrote your memoir, Girl in a Band, which is very honest and very open. And then you have this record that is not memoir, but I'm wondering, can you be more honest or open in an album that you can be in a memoir? Because people are judging and looking at like the facts versus what you're talking about in a song. Can you actually be more emotionally vulnerable and more open that way?
Yeah, I think so. I also like to use the word you because it can also refer to the audience. But, you know, other records, certainly like Bodyhead Records or the first Bodyhead record, it was so emotional. And a lot of people think I was writing about my life, but it was also writing about Catherine, or inspired by this French filmmaker, Catherine Briart. Like specifically the song Last Mistress, it's like her movie. But a lot of people, I'm sure, took it to be about my life.
Kim Gordon's new record is called No Home Record. Kim, thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up on The Frame, the film Atlantiques is both a love story and a ghost story. Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Maté Diop's film Atlantiques is a love story about a 17-year-old Senegalese girl and a struggling construction worker who are kept apart by forces beyond their control. Atlantiques is the first film directed by a black woman to screen in competition at the Cannes Film Festival. It also won the Grand Prix Award there this year. When I spoke with Diop at the Middleburg Film Festival, we began with how her 2009 documentary short of the same name led to her making a narrative feature-length version of Atlantiques.
It was a moment in Senegal, in Dakar, where a lot of young people would migrate to reach Spain, to escape unemployment, to escape a very difficult economical situation. And at that time, mass media would really talk about it through the perspective of, in a very abstract way, you know, through statistic, and the approach was mostly very miserabilist. And as a French Senegalese person and filmmaker, I was really, how can I say, I was close to what was going on. I met some people who was about to leave, and I made a film about somebody who just had returned from that migration. And so I've been a close witness to that situation, and I used the tools of cinema to approach that reality in a more sensitive, existential, and mythological approach. And as this young man was telling me his true story, it was true, it was what he experienced, but the way he told about his crossing was already so epic and so mythical and so full of metaphors and symbolic, that the way he told himself made the film shift into something more than a documentary. And a couple of years later, I decided to, on the same theme, to write a feature, because I wanted to address to a larger audience, and also to really go further about the supernatural and fantasy approach of the film.
When you made your short, there was somebody who spoke to you who said something that you said at the time struck you, and that is, when you make the decision to leave, you're really already dead.
That's Serine, the hero of Atlantic's The Short, who told that to me that night. And it's true that the numbers of boys I've been talking with who have been told me about their project to leave Dakar to Spain were so much obsessed and possessed by the desire of being elsewhere that they were no longer here anymore, which gave that very ghosty feeling of being seated in front of boys in flesh and bones in front of you, but whose minds were so far away from here. And I think this, amongst other things, really made me think of writing a ghost film about that moment, about that situation.
We're talking with Maté Diop about her film Atlantiques, or if you want to say it in the Americanized way, Atlantics. This is in some ways a movie about refugees. It's also a movie about what's left behind, because so many stories about refugees are about the journey, but not about the people who don't make the journey and how their lives are changed by the people who leave.
Exactly. Actually, that's why I decided to dedicate a movie to this lost youth in the sea, yes, but from the perspective of the living and of the woman who stayed behind, because it was also, from my own point of view, I thought it felt just more right to talk about where I stood, you know? It's about the experience of losing these boys and how these women transcend and face their own reality without the presence of the men. It's really how the life of these women are reinvented by the absence of these men.
This is a movie that was shot in and around Senegal, and you also use Senegalese actors. So I want to ask you about finding your actors and why it was important to have local actors, even if they don't always have a lot of experience to play these parts.
Oh, for me, the fact to use actors and people of the who live in the place I shot is very natural. I mean, the film is it's really a film which is really happening in a very specific, precise place. The name of the neighborhood is Tiaroy. It's in the suburbs of Dakar, and the character connected to the story were obviously had to be found in the same place, and the film had to be shot for me in Wolof, which is the language people speak there, to be as close as the humanity and the internal imaginary of these people. So it was, as most of the characters are quite young in the film, they are between 18 and 25. Because they're that age, I wanted to do street casting, because you don't really find professional actors of this age in Senegal, but mostly because I have a very documentary approach to casting. To give you an example, for the character of Suleiman, the lover of Ada, who is a worker and who hasn't been paid for 4 months on his work construction site, I went to search for my actor in a war construction site because I needed somebody who knows about what he's defending in the role. The people I choose for the character are bringing all their knowledge or their experience or their soul and their person to the character, which is everything.
Matti, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
Matti Diop's film Atlantiques is in select theaters starting November 15th. And that is it for today. But don't forget to tune in to The Frame Weekend, Saturday at 2. Thanks to the team that produces The Frame and to Taylor McFerrin, who provides our opening theme music. I'm John Horn. Thanks for listening. We're back here Monday at the Moen Broadcast Center.